This is KPFK in Los Angeles, listener sponsored Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California. This is Folk Scene. I'm Howard Larman. Our guests are Phil Alvin, James Harmon, and I should say the mysterious rhythm section, which we'll identify later. Is that all right?
Right.
Okay. Willie Dixon. Go ahead, Phil.
Well, this goes out to the great Bob Hyde. Mm-hmm. It was one of his favorite records.
Did you ever take a trip, baby, on the Mobile line? Hey, Lordy, mama, mama, hey, Lordy, papa, papa, hollering about the Mobile line. That's a road to ride, baby, is your trouble mine? Well, I got a letter, this is the way it read. Come home, man, cause your love is dead. Well, I got my suitcase, bundled up my clothes. Hey, Lordy, mama, mama, hey, Lordy, papa, papa, hollering about bundling up clothes. When I got there, she was laying on the cooling boards. Well, there were two white horses standing on the burying ground. You should have seen their faces when they let her down. Holler, when I die, honey, I'm gonna stop by France. Hey, Lordy, mama, mama, hey, Lordy, papa, papa, holler, I'm gonna stop by France. I'm gonna stop by France just to give these girls a chance. When Daddy dies, don't bury Daddy at all. Lordy, mama, mama, hey, Lordy, papa, papa, holler, not bearing dad at all. Just pick up my bones, baby, in the alcohol. Hello, heaven, daddy wants to see your telephone. Hey, Lordy, mama, mama, hey, Lordy, papa, papa, holler, not the telephone. So when daddy's gone, you can talk to him on the phone. Did you ever take a trip, baby, on the Mobile line? Hey, Lordy, mama, mama, hey, Lordy, papa, papa, hollering about the Mobile line. Oh, that's the road to ride, baby, he's your trouble and mine.
Phil, I busted a string on the very first song. Well,
it shouldn't happen. It never happens to me.
Let this go out as a protest to the guitar string making industry as a whole.
Yeah, exactly.
We're fed up with it and not going to put up with it.
Well, these things pop when you pull up on them the right way, I guess. Yeah.
Need your guitar case for this?
We're going to need a guitar case here and a prayer.
Yeah.
A guitar case and a prayer. Or
knowing Phil Alvin for as long as I have, I can put $50 cash right now on the fact that there's no...
There should be two packs of string this time to take them out of here.
Didn't have my cord. Last your guitar case was two pair of nylon socks.
They were mine, Christina.
Phil, first of all, congratulations on your new album.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
I'm so worried about the string now. I can't even think.
Yeah.
It was the greatest thing to. I mean, if anybody, for those of you, most of you who don't know about that album, you know, I got to cut some tunes with Sun Ra and the orchestra, and the Dirty Dozen Brass Band, which was, I mean, these guys are playing jazz. And Sun Ra always did, and even though no matter how far out Sun Ra went, because he was trained so much from Fletcher Henderson, when jazz talked to people, when jazz was popular music. James, it ain't in there. That's my
sock, though. There is a sock.
There is a sock.
Believe it or not.
Those are my
okay.
That's my mojo working.
Well, we're going to be down to get my mojo working here.
Anyway, the album.
You did.
What's the response to the album? How's it going?
Much better than I didn't know what people's response was, and I was asked to make the record by the record company came and asked me. I didn't want to foul up, you know, people's minds to whether the blasters were there or anything.
Right.
So when they asked me, I said, well, I'll make those foreign styles of American music that I can't take on a road, you know, with the blast. I can't take a 15-piece horn section, and I can't just stop the whole show and play with a fiddle player, play by myself. And when I gave it to the record company, I didn't know if they knew. They'd never seen anything. All these different styles, jazz, country blues, you know, city blues. And the response has been great. I mean, all over the world, you know, I've been getting reviews, and I'm flabbergasted. I'm really surprised.
Now you have a solo career going separate from the Blasters now? Is that how it is?
Oh, no, you know, I tried. That's exactly what I didn't want to have happen, you know.
I see.
So in as much as the... if it doesn't conflict with the Blasters, then I go out and maybe can play a gig or something. But I don't want to start doing that too much. But I always played alone, you know. Even when the Blasters came together, as James Harmon right here, that will verify. As I decided I'd start playing again after I got out of school, so I was just playing alone. And then Bill Bateman started coming down to the show, and then James came. In fact, I took the gig over for Gene Taylor. Mm-hmm. And we sort of built the Blasters up originally. In fact, we had a band. It was James Harmon, Willie J from the James Harmon Band. Me and Bill Bateman was the first time that we started going again, about 78 or 77, something like that. And, I always played alone. When I play with the Blasters, I pick like this. You know, I pick country. I don't use a pick. I play the same thing. If the whole band stopped, you hear me, I'd sound like I'm picking country blues. So, it's not a separate career. It's considered as an amendment to the song American Music, where we talk about jazz and country blues and things. However, you can't show that with a 5-piece electric band unless you put on one of these kind of shows where you stop and have a guy go out and play alone for a while and bring it in. And that takes away the urgency, the immediacy of the thing. So I try to keep the solo thing a little separate. Yeah, am I in trouble or am I?
You're on this string, man.
I'm going to have to just play without an E string.
Okay.
Well, that's all right.
What do you play next?
But your E string wasn't long enough?
No, it didn't make my string look like it busted out there too far out.
They don't make them like they used to.
All right, James, hit an A for me on your harmonica there. All right, I think we're in pretty good shape here. I think what we should do, I was listening to Willie and James talking down there, and he played that J.B. Lenore album. There's a song off of that Willie Dixon made in the early 60s, and these guys were doing some important sounds making, you know, when they were cutting those records, cut short by J.B. Lenore's death. But I mean, Willie was there. Willie's the only guy that could continue that sound. So one of my favorite songs that they did on that thing is a thing called the Voodoo Music. So we'll do it here without the E string. Make them jump and act real crazy. The voodoo music all over the world. Look what it's doing to the beautiful girls. Make them jump and act real crazy. The voodoo music gonna knock them dead. The voodoo. The voodoo. The voodoo music got the whole world on the go. The voodoo music's expecting the boys to jump real crazy and act for joy. Make them think they're controlling the girls, or make them think that they're controlling the world. The voodoo. The voodoo. The voodoo music got the whole world on the go. The voodoo music all over the world. Look what it's doing to the beautiful girls.
got them jumping, acting real crazy. The voodoo music gonna knock them dead. The voodoo. The voodoo. The voodoo music got the whole world on the go. The voodoo music's expecting the boys to jump real crazy and act so joy. Make them think they're controlling the girls. Make them think that they're controlling the world. The voodoo. The voodoo. The voodoo music got the whole world on the go. The voodoo music got the whole world on the go. The voodoo music all over the world. Look what it's doing to the beautiful girls. Got them jumping, acting real crazy. The voodoo music's gonna knock them dead. The voodoo. The voodoo. The voodoo music got the whole world on the go.
Our guests are Phil Alvin.
Songs of Easter Ring there.
James Harmon and Willie Dixon. And yes. Phil unplugged his guitar and changed the string. And
I'm sorry. Could you hear that guitar at all? Not at all.
Well, oh, man.
That's all right. You got an acapella version of it.
Does it look from here like you'll be making more solo records?
Well, I think I probably will because, I mean, they've talked about it. The record sold enough that they made their money. You know, I don't believe, but somebody did.
It's a whole story, isn't it?
So, yeah. So, I mean, I'm a singer. And as a singer, you don't get to represent that too much in the world. Now, you're supposed to be a singer-songwriter nowadays. Like, you consider Muddy Waters was a singer, you know. And Willie Dixon wrote his song. You know, Alan Wolfe was a singer. And then sometime in the middle 60s or something, as Bob Dylan himself said, you know, he shot Tin Pan Alley, killed it. Because all of a sudden we had the idea that there was a thing called a singer-songwriter. Now, there have been. You know, every now and then it happened. Not very often. So as a result, you don't get to practice singing. You know, the idea of a hook, when people put hooks inside of a song, most tasteful hook writer of all time, the hook sort of really got stuck in the middle 60s if you're not a good songwriter, and if you write a good line, what's the easiest way to get another good line? Say it again. Say the same line again.
Yeah.
If you can't sing very good, and you can sing one line good, what's the easiest way to get another line? Sing it again. Now, couple that with the fact that repetitive hooks seem to hypnotize people and put them best into the state to be to receive advertising or to calm down at the dentist office or anything like that. And you give them 30 years. You give them 30 years to pump the money through the system. It's only been, Greg, they've only been putting records out really for 30 years radio importance. Before that, it was just records importance.
Right.
So after about 30 years, that animal's got a pretty good idea how to keep its thing. You've made a music that was once American folk music, rock and roll and jazz and everything like that. They've turned it into a corporate animal, which has now separated it, you know, from what.
Right.
People now know that there's there's the music they play on the radio, and then there's the music we go see. And, you know, and sometimes it's the same, and sometimes it's not the same. You call something rock and roll, blues, rhythm and blues, everybody's got markets for all of that. So I like to be able to practice singing a song. On that album, one of the reasons I call them song stories, there's a lot of songs in there that never say the same line twice. Never. Now, that makes you so responsible as a singer to have to maintain people's attention. There is nothing for you to fall back onto. You have to make them hear the story, and you got to use your words. And we can, you take Bruce Springsteen, who I have greatest admiration for, his politics and everything like that. He wrote a song called I Was Born in the USA.
Right.
Nobody really knew what the song meant. Because they didn't hear in between the hook.
Now, part of it's the fault that the people don't listen there. The other part of it is you're supposed to grab them and stick them inside there and say, the finish part. And if you don't do it, if you don't pull them in there like that, you are going to be misinterpreted. So I particularly trying to separate. I want to re-get that. I want to hear Bing Crosby. I want to hear Jackie Wilson and Clyde McFadder again. As a result, I need singers and songwriters and the occasional few guys who are singer-songwriters. and that's that, you know. Yeah. And most of the guys that are singer-songwriters that I've seen, because it seems to live, they don't live in the same section of the brain. Singing is in a section much more toward the animal. And songwriting is a much more cerebral event where you talk, you go into your language and to...
Yeah.
And they're two different kinds of personalities, usually. And a lot of those guys, Hank Williams, something like that, they burn fast, you know, because there's this kind of fight. And I don't know that that's for sure, but it seems that way. And there are very few guys that you really say. It's not to say that guys who write songs shouldn't sing their songs.
Right.
Absolutely. You see a great deal of the personal connection with the song. But there are other people whose instrument is bigger and perhaps are capable of opening things out, and the bringing the two of them together is what we should care for, is what's important to music, you know. Sometimes it's better this way. In the 20s and in the 30s, a guy'd write a song, everybody'd record it. Just a Gigolo, Russ Columbo recorded, Benny Goodman, Bing Crosby recorded, Rudy Valley, all of them recorded, see who can do it the best. Who does this song the best? We don't have anything like that now, nothing like it. I wrote it, I sang it, it's on my record, I got the publishing, I got everything.
But isn't that part of the corporate mentality, that they want their performers, their recording artists, to be writers so they can get the publishing?
Well, that was, you know, that meant more. That's why we're going to be able to move from that. In the 60s, when they were making the illegal contracts that they would take the publishing of the people who were on their records, then the record companies were greatly in support of the idea of having a singer-songwriter. It made economic sense, because if I get them on the label, I don't have to pay the mechanicals that I'm paying out to these guys. I'm paying part of them to myself. And Willie, I mean, the guys that had to fight through that baloney in the 50s and 60s, and the class action suit that someday is up the road for all these guys. If you got all the money back from publishing, you'd have to move Beverly Hills to Compton and Compton to Beverly Hills, and that's just the facts, you know. The money and the publishing industry is so huge with all the money of all those writers in the 50s and 60s, and musicians still don't know how to get paid for records. In the 1920s, before they recorded, you know, poor people, a musician only got paid when he was there. How could you hear him someplace else? And so what came up as musicians were guys who could stand and play their song and get paid for it. So they didn't, like, group together in groups. Now, publishing had sheet printed music, and for 200 years they knew how to get paid when somebody heard their song where they weren't. But musicians ain't figured it out yet. You make a record, the amount of money, if you made a gold record as a musician, not counting the publishing and the writing, as a gold record, you make a gold record, you'll get $100,000. Now, if you took 2 months to make that record, you'd have lost $100,000 on the road, and you're $100,000 in debt to the record company for doing it, and they recoup the entire debt with just 10% of the profits that are coming in off your royalties. Now, you tell me that a musician made that deal? It wasn't a... They make them.
Don't you think, like, musicians get carried away by their music and the idea of performing, and therefore they don't tend to be very good business
people? Well, it's true of an artist. I think that's one of the parts. But the other thing is, I think they took business away from musicians. Musicians used to be businessmen. I'm sure the guys in the South Side of Chicago weren't not. Muddy Waters ran his business, you know. Or so. I mean, well, I'm
really shaking his head here.
He really shaking his head. No, I'm sorry. But I think with kids, when you're young, if you learn how to play music, you learn how to communicate with somebody early. You're getting response from people. You don't necessarily have to get and grow like that. Plus, the ways that money come to musicians, it's just now really getting settled. You know, the public's really now we can focus in on it. It was evolving when Willie was playing, changing every 2 weeks, 3 weeks on how you got paid. And knew about publishing. I know about you.
I can't help it, but most of the time, you didn't get paid at all.
For real, yeah.
That's right. I was there.
Yeah.
But for those people that join us later, our guests are Phil Alden, James Harmon, and Willie Dixon. What do you play next?
Well, I think song's the E string here. Let's do a tune, little Walter tune that I always like. It's called "Just Keep a Lovin' Her." You know, remember that thing? get an A harmonica. I'm playing the key E, J.
Okay, Phil.
Well, a nickel is a nickel and a dime is a dime. Got a little girl crazy about cherry wine, but I just keep loving her. I just keep loving her. I don't know the reason why. Well, come back, baby, try me one more time. If you don't love me, babe, don't have to pay me no mind. But I just keep loving her. I just keep loving her. I don't know the reason why. Well, the Mississippi River's so long, deep and wide, I can't see my good gal on the other side. But I just keep loving her. I just keep loving her. I don't know the reason why. If you don't love me, babe, don't have to pay me no mind. But I just keep loving her. I just keep loving her. I don't know the reason why. Well, bye-bye, baby, bye-bye, baby. Well, I will meet you in heaven. I will meet you in hell. But I just keep loving her. I just keep loving her. Just keep loving her. I don't know the reason why.
He's got me down.
He got me. If anybody's got the rhythm, it's Lloyd.
Yeah, that's right. You know, that's so right. God, all of it. That's what I mean. To play with that rhythm is just great. It's like a man, is that a rock?
Tell me about the founding of the Blasters. They were referring to them as the Boys from Downey or something like that.
Well, yeah, James will back me down. All the guys in the Blasters grew up together, and in amongst about 15 or 20 guys all hanging around. Downey, the older guys, Bill Connors is probably the best known, who was the first guitar player for Return to Forever, Chick Corea's stuff and all that. He's a very excellent jazz guitar player. And him being there, being so good, excited a lot of these younger guitar players, because they were playing like Eric Clapton and things like that. And there was sufficient, because we're near the Bell Gardens and we're into Pico Rivera, you heard a lot of Jimmy Reed, a lot of Okie songs, Hank Williams and stuff like that. You learned how to play all these musics, and as you would go around, and so this pool of guys, there were so many guys, Dave Carroll, Gary Massey, all these guys on that record, on the Daddy Rolling Stone, the drummer and the two guitar players, are all old Downeyonians.
So we had a real good peer group. And then when we were about 16 or 17, we ran into a guy named Ernie Franklin, who was the son of Mary Franklin, who was Lee Allen's girlfriend at the time. So he said, why don't you come down to the York Club? And we went down there, and there was Big Joe Turner singing with Lee Allen. And they let us in the club, you know, they know how old we were. And I went up on stage and sang Wee Baby Blues in front of Joe Turner. I mean, I just sang Voodoo Blues in front of Lily Dixon. And I sang Wee Baby Blues a 50-year-old, and it tickled him, man. They took us under their wing. All these guys from down there, we'd have the band. The band at that time, I think, its name was the Night Shift. Mm-hmm. This was about 1968, 69, 70, till about 71, I think I had it together. And that had Gene Taylor, the piano player, and all the flavor of the Blaster player, James Harmon band, and the Canned Heat, and many other things. Finest piano player around now that Roosevelt Sykes passed on. You know. I guess little brother Montgomery is still alive, isn't he?
Mm-hmm. Is that right? He's dead. He died about a year ago.
Oh, sorry to hear that. No kidding?
Yeah. I didn't know
That's right. I completely forgot about that.
A little more to hear, though.
Roosevelt Sykes. What a man he was. Dude, that guy made records from 1929 until the day he died. And it was just, and he'd walk in a suit with that same hat and just sit down and play like his hands weren't even connected to his voice. Man, we saw him that night. I was crying. He was gorgeous. Here was this. He must have been 85 or 86 years old, something like that. From 1929. Now, how many, what were Roosevelt Sykes' hits? He was there though, and believe me, he'll be there a lot longer remembered than all, everybody else. So when disco came in really heavy, it was difficult to get gigs. I'm talking about the Blasters down in the scene at the time. It was very hard to get gigs. You used to be able at the beginning of disco to trick them. You'd go sing The Thrill Is Gone or something that was a hit on the radio. Yeah. Then they get you in. Then when the people caught in, once they saw that the people dug what you did, everything was okay. Well, by 1974, 75, no way. There was nothing you could do. You know, Freddie's Dead was maybe the closest, and I think that's even a little late after that. So everybody kind of just, the music scene was really tired, you know. The music on the radio was particularly tired. It's tired again now. And there was no youthful energy. It had sort of been pulled over by everybody moving into their calm and down period. Everybody had money and all that. So we kind of took it easy for a while. Gene Taylor, you know, guys would play local bars in their hometown. You weren't trying to make a, you know, you didn't care. It didn't bother you. You wanted to play what you played. And when the Sex Pistols and the punk movement and all that stuff started coming, it actually did a great deal of good for American music. It was the British guys coming over and handing you back. You know, they took it away for about 15 or 20 years, and they come back and hand you the raw energy of youth, of kids just banging on their guitars in a garage like they've been doing for as long as they had garages, as long as they had guitars, getting all their energy out, and it opened up the energy again. So we started, when we were playing, you know, started putting this thing together. The thing was, you didn't have to worry about people getting upset if you started playing hard or singing blues hard.
String.
That's
String
incredible.
Has arrived for Phil Alvin. We're going to get him playing on all six here.
I'll get on all six strings.
Yes.
So, you know what? I really think I'm interviewing Willie Dixon. The first songs you wrote for a country western band or something like that? I read it in an Airplane magazine. Do you believe that?
Oh, yeah. Probably so. I don't know. I haven't heard any of them. Once in a while I hear something that we done, you know, but I don't hear none of the guys that was doing them way back then. A guy back there named Tom Jones and all like that. And guys out of Texas and places. When I was a kid, they was doing my songs like Laundry Man and Dusty Jitterbug and all this kind of stuff.
I never heard those.
I know.
Still on?
I know, huh?
You still?
Oh, are you kidding? I know. I know them all. Yeah, Sweet Louise, all those kind of things. You
think blues musicians in general don't get a lot of credit for writing?
Oh, no, they don't get no credit for writing until here lately, and they got less money.
Yeah.
Work up a thing and get it up and somebody else take the money. That didn't make sense.
What, have you talked to lawyers? Is any lawyers interested in taking the case, the class case?
Yeah, well, the lawyers don't know nothing about it themselves. And then you know how they do. They hide these things.
Well, they're scared. That's what I figured.
You can understand how they hide these things because just listen at the incidences in the paper now about the president. You can tell they hide everything. Anytime you didn't get the red-handed, you forget it.
Boy, is I happy they got that guy. That's like entertainment on TV now, you know.
Well, not him. Not only him, but the president's ahead of him. They didn't get
for
sure. Until he
got the Nixon. He was going to get away with it, you know, and just be as cool as he could be, taking all the money and giving it.
You don't have to worry about it because these guys that have the higher type of education, they know the other fellas down here don't know what's going on no way. So all you got to do is get up there and make the right conversation and say the right thing and get the shaking hands and say, well, I'm glad to meet you. And I met the Secretary of State. I met the President. I met the Treasurer. I met this guy. Oh, yeah, they're great people because I met him, you know.
Although
they take all the money and everything, but that's what I got educated for.
Well, not if Phil's back together again here. I think we'd have another
chance. Well, thanks to Mary Alden.
Yes. Mary Catherine Alden.
Mary Catherine Alden. But is there another Mary Alden?
I don't know.
There must be because she started really pushing that Catherine. When I met her, she was just Mary Alden.
Okay, well, the Blasters, the band, has got stuck with a name, a word called rockabilly. Mm-hmm. And I've tried since the very beginning. I never heard that word, okay? I never heard that word, and I learned how to play this from Okies. You know, I know Okies that were, you know, their teeth were knocked out, they were laying down in front of the tumbleweeds by the horse tie, and they called it rhythm and blues. That's what they called that stuff. And that's because a Muddy Waters record would be right next to a Jerry Lee Lewis record, and there wasn't any difference to these guys about that. They knew the difference between black and white, and maybe even being Okie racist, they still knew that this was what you played. You don't play this. Now, rock in the late 40s, or even in the 20s, meant predominantly black music. You know, it was, what you say, there was old-time country rock.
You see, long time ago, you know, they used to call it blues, and they changed it to jazz, and they changed it to blues, and they changed it to rock, rock and roll, and country and western and everything. But you see, the thing about it, the blues is the roots of it all. And all they had to do was change the arrangement.
You change the radio,
and
the instrumentation.
When you change the arrangement, you got another music. And they do that in order to keep the original one from getting the credit for it. I tell you, just take that Big Mama Thorne. She made Hound Dog, Blue Suede Shoes. Hell, you couldn't give it away. Yeah. The press has made it, and boom. Hey, what do you do? You
and
rock.
Johnny Otis said.
Yeah, rock. And then, boom, they went to the sky. Mm-hmm. And she still didn't get a damn thing out of it.
Never got nothing for that.
This has been going on for years, you know. So this is the reason that this Blues Heaven Foundation. I thought about all these things years ago, and I said, now how in the heck is it that everybody in the brothers can get something out of this, but the folks that originally made it?
That's been right.
So then I figured if we got a little publicity on it and publicize it and advertise it and kind of show it up and let people see the difference between it, which was nothing, why then we could get involved in something. And so far today, by going around in various parts of the world and exposing it like this, then the blues seem to be coming back.
Yeah, well, I think there's more work for guys.
Yeah, because many radio stations I used to go to, man, with all the best numbers, and that guy said, "Oh man, just like the records you got there." Guy said, "Oh man, we can't play this." I said, "Why?" "Because it's the blues." Mm-hmm. Now, well, what's the difference between the blues and rest? The blues are true facts of life, expressing words, songs, inspiration, feeling, and understanding. And this is what it's got. So, what are you looking for?
It's
that simple.
And people think, when you say the word blues, people lots of times think of just a slow song.
Yeah.
And that's so much baloney. Most blues probably isn't even slow. And even the ones that they try to do slow, were actually like a Jimmy Reed song or something like that, actually had quite a brisk little rhythm, but it was just done so tastefully. You see? And guys can't cover that. People think B.B. King, you know. And sort of, so I'll lead this into this tune. The Blasters get pinned with this thing, rockabilly. But they used to billy everything because it meant a hillbilly. It meant an Okie. They didn't like Okies either. They were poor guys, you know. So in 1950 or 51 or 53, if somebody said, and if you guys did, I mean, they'd have rockabilly boogie. Rockabilly meant
hillbilly playing black music. It meant something then. Mm-hmm. Now, in 1970 or 71, it meant an Italian in a pink shirt standing in front of a white Cadillac with real skinny arms. That's what rockabilly meant. It didn't mean anything to me at all, man. A rockabilly, I never did anything that went illy at the end. Nothing I do does illy. I don't know illy.
Is some of that identification for the Blasters being their first record on Rolling Rock, which was...
Well, they, see, that's, which was, I went on Rolling Rock. There wasn't any other record labels. This guy was sitting and talking. I knew what they meant by rockabilly. That I read an article about Rock and Ronnie. And it says, you know, he was looking for authentic rockabilly. So I'd seen enough Okies playing. You know, I told Rock, I called him up on the phone. I said, look, I got a tape of my band. Like tape James made. Tape of my band.
Ron Weiser we're talking
about. I said, but I said, I got my guitar in the back, too. Yeah, Rock and Ronnie Weiser from Rolling Rock. I got my guitar in the back, and I can be over at your house in an hour, and I'll play you authentic rockabilly. So we took the, he, finally I talked him into it. I was hollering mounting him on the phone. So we went over there. I took him the tape. He sticks it on. And I'm telling, that's when we told him American music. He says rockabilly. I said, I don't know what rockabilly, man. We call it American music. Let's call it that, all right? And so an Okie from Englewood came over to Ronnie's, the truck driver, to pick up a bunch of records to send to Europe while this tape is playing. The Okie walks in and he says to Rock and Ronnie, he says, hey, what's that? Who's that? And he goes, and Ronnie just fluffed him up, didn't know what he was talking about. He says, no, who's that playing? And I said, it's me, it's us guys. And then I said, well, what do you call that, man? And he looked at Rock and Ronnie, and he said, well, that's rhythm and blues, man. That's what that is. Rockabilly, rockabilly. And when we made that record, you look at the record, the tune, the first record we made with Rock and Ronnie, I Wish You Would, Billy Boy Arnold's tune is on there. The Barefoot Rock, you know, it's just little Junior Parker and Dee Malone. And we made 21 songs for Rock and Ronnie, including like 20 It's Love, 24 Hours a Day, which was Earl Gaines with the high toppers on Excella. All these great songs. Now, Ronnie selected 14 or 12, whatever, picked most of the ones that generally are classified as rockabilly, and then put that thing out. So we really got hard on it. There's a guy who really laid down a great deal of the style of what they call rockabilly, or the early stuff. Elvis Presley's first records were his songs, Arthur Big Boy Crudup.
Right.
The man's much maligned in the literature, I guess because nobody thinks Elvis is a big enough name by himself. They have to say that little Arthur Crudup was just sort of a mediocre blues singer. He was a very influential blues singer. Man, everybody was doing his songs.
Yeah, song. I was with him.
You did?
Yeah.
Oh, the Checker record.
That's right.
Oh, Checker.
Oh, man, you don't have a copy of that. For real?
Yeah.
Boy, I loved it. I love talking about that.
That's when
I want to know, did he tune his guitar? Do you know? Did he tune his guitar open, or did he tune it?
He tuned it open.
He tuned it open.
He played it open.
All right.
He didn't have no.
That's why my fingers have to go like this when I'm trying to do it.
Yeah, he capoed it to fifth.
I better do this.
He's got that tone.
So, here's the mean old Frisco Blues by Arthur Big Boy Crudup. Little Rockabilly by Willie Dixon.
Took my babe away, man, been blowed back out on me. Well, I'm standing, Lord, looking, watching that southern whistle blow. Yes, I'm standing, looking, watching that southern whistle blow. She didn't catch that old southern. The one who went to the one who went. Well, my mama, she done told me, and my papa told me too. Yes, my mama told me, papa done told me too. Every woman that grin in your face, man, she ain't no friend to you. got no special rider here. I ain't got no special rider here. I might leave, 'cause I don't feel welcome here. Yes, my mama told me, Papa told me too. Every woman that grin in your face, man, she ain't no friend to you. I ain't got no special ride here. I ain't got no special rider here. I might leave, 'cause I don't feel welcome here. With that mean old Frisco and that low down Santa Fe. Yeah, that mean old Frisco, low down Santa Fe. Done took my baby away, man, they blew the hell out of me.
Our guests are Phil Alvin, James Harmon, and Willie Dixon. And now that you're all warmed up and you got all six strings on your guitar, how about another song?
All right. We won't waste any time today. Here's an old song about a steamboat gambler called Stack of Lee. Everybody knows who Stack of Lee is. Here's the oldest song I know of. I'll tell you what, we'll do another. How many, can I do two or one? How many I got there?
You got plenty of time.
Let's play harp on something. What do you think I got you on here?
Maybe I'll do Man's Trouble Blues. What I'd rather do, you know, I didn't see this movie, but there's some movie Crossroads or something. And they talk about Robert Johnson and all that stuff. But from what I understand, the story of going down he made the song Crossroads. The story of going down there and having a guy going to the crossroads at midnight and having a guy come give you a guitar came from a guy named Tommy Johnson, who was about 10 years before Robert Johnson. And Tommy Johnson was the guy who made the canned heat took their name from, because he used to drink that Sterno. And he, Howlin' Wolf, learned directly from him. But this guy was mystical. I mean, he sang and played in this beautiful, weird way. And I'm certainly not going to do it any justice, but I'll give my... There's this famous song, and Willie must know this, it's a very influential blues song called Big Road Blues, and he was the man that laid that thing down originally. Key of D.
Big road by myself, now don't you hear me crying, Lord, I ain't going down. Big road by myself. If I can't can. Can you, babe, Lord, I'll kiss somebody else. Take it, poor boy's money. Sure, Lord, don't take mine, now don't you. In the crime, take it, poor boy's money. Sure, Lord, won't take mine. Take it, poor boy's money, won't you. Sure, Lord, won't take mine. And now, what makes you do me? Do like you do, like you do, do, do. Don't you hear me now? What makes you do me? Do like you do, do, do. Well, you ain't gonna do it like you. Don't hold cherry red. Do like you do, like you do, do, do. Won't you hear me now? What makes you do me? Do like you do, do, do. Well, you ain't gonna do like you. Don't hold cherry red. If the sun's gonna shine, my back will someday. Now don't you? In the crying, Lord, the sun's gonna shine. My baby goes in day. Yeah, the wind's gonna change now. Blow my blues away. And I ain't going down the big road by myself. Now don't you? In the crying, Lord, I ain't going down the big road by myself. I can't care you, babe, but I care somebody else.
Big road by myself. You, I like that.
Did you hear that by Tommy Jones? I know the Chicago Blues made it. I mean, Floyd Jones, I think, made that record. Yeah. Big World Blues, he called it.
Yeah. I heard it long before he did.
Yeah, it must have been hit this. Yeah. You know, is he? I saw him in. No, it was Moody. No, it was Snooky Pryor. I saw him with you. Oh. Is he still doing all right?
I talked with him last week.
Boy, he's Snooky's wonderful. And that the boogie twist. What a song. Boy, that was one of the songs, man.
He's funny too.
Him and Homesick James working together now. They've been working together off and on a long time.
Okay.
Yeah, I had him with me
Homesick
for a while.
James.
Yeah.
Homesick James. Yeah. Oh, Roy Williams?
Homesick James Williams?
Yeah.
For those people that just joined us, or joined us late, our guests are Phil Alvin, James Harmon, and Willie Dixon, and we have time for one more.
Okay. Well, let me slap this.
We're going to have to do this again, you know.
I got to thank James and Willie, because if they wouldn't have been here when I busted that string, I'd have been in great trouble. That was a lucky thing they were here. Okay. So, you know, we talked about Tommy Johnson. Everybody knows all this Robert Johnson stuff. And so that's good. And they should know Robert Johnson. And everybody's heard the St. Louis Blues. Everybody going, you know, oh, the St. Louis Blues are from St. Louis. But that's not St. Louis, Missouri. That's East St. Louis, Illinois. It's on the other side of the river that the music came from. And the king of East St. Louis in the late 20s and 30s was Petey Wheatstraw, the devil's son-in-law, the high sheriff of hell. And all of Robert Johnson's first records were, or a lot of his records, were Petey Wheatstraw songs, Little Queen of Spades and all that, that stuff. That went, hey. That was Petey Wheatstraw's trademark. Now, when all the record collectors and all these guys decided they'd tell you what's good blues and bad blues in the 60s and stuff, they'd rank on Petey Wheatstraw and Bill Brunsey and people like that who had big followers in the 30s because they made so many records, you know, and their style got so prevalent that it overshadowed a lot of the country blues guys. But I think when Robert Johnson, and Petey Wheatstraw also played guitar, mostly played piano, but when he played guitar, he played in open tuning like Robert Johnson. And I think when Robert Johnson went up, since they'd mixed up the story with Tommy Johnson already anyway, when Robert Johnson went away for a year or whatever it was and came back and could play, and they said, where'd you go? He said, well, I went to learn from the devil's side. I think he went up to East St. Louis, and played guitar with Petey Wheatstraw. Because he learned how to, he was come back, he was singing. Son House was not making that Petey Wheatstraw trick. That was, it's a, there's definite, he'd been listening to Petey Wheatstraw records. But he died before Petey Wheatstraw did. And so I do this tune, the Gangster Blues, that I'm sure Robert Johnson would have done had he lived, but he didn't, so I'll do it for him.